Hey, Rich Lowry here. If you're like me, you're a last-minute Christmas shopper and a terrible gift wrapper, but let me make this easy for you. You know the gift everyone wants? It's a better night's sleep. Boll & Branch never disappoints with the highest quality sheets, blankets, pillows, and throws. Plus, their holiday packaging makes your gift look and feel special. I got to tell you, Boll & Branch sheets meet my standards, but much more importantly, they've met my wife's standards. Husband and wife team Scott and Missy Tannen founded Boll & Branch to create a new standard in bedding by doing things the right way, not the easy way. Boll & Branch holds themselves to high standards across the board, from sourcing pure organic cotton to putting workers' rights first. And it's not just their sheets that are made the right way. Their pillows, bath towels, and robes are too. So treat yourself and your loved ones to the new standard in bedding from Boll & Branch. Their gifts come wrapped and ready in their special holiday packaging. Order by December 19th for guaranteed delivery by Christmas.
Shop the holiday semi-annual sale from December 9th to December 15th and get 20% off
at ballandbranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com. Exclusions may apply. Please check it out.
Bienvenidos, that's California for welcome to the December 9th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim. I'm president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. And you can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an author, not a political commentator, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. Thank you for that.
Hi, buddy. How are you?
I'm a little busy. It's been a crazy, crazy few days, few weeks, few months, but I'm back here in New York City. I just flew back from Palm Beach last night.
Is that why you're so sunny looking? Because you really do look sunny.
No, I did a big National Review event in Palm Beach for the book on Tuesday night. And I just got back like an hour ago from a big event here in New York City that was taped by C-SPAN with Amity Schles interviewing me about the book.
Oh,
and
my
gosh. That'll air on C-SPAN next week.
Oh, fantastic. We'll provide a link as soon as we have that.
Book TV. So that'll come out next week and it'll be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I had breakfast yesterday in Newport Beach with your friend and mine, Rich Lowry, and NRI's Stephanie Cates. It was wonderful, illuminating. I mean, just, you know, who doesn't love having the editor's podcast basically at your breakfast table live? It was great.
Yeah.
Hey,
good
there's
people.
Yes. How is the book deal going, by the way? I mean, in addition to C-SPAN and Amity, and we're getting lots of requests, of course, for the book.
Well, it's going a little bit too well because Amazon ran out of stock of the hardcover, which was just surreal. You know, we were into the third printing already. And so the supply chain stuff is real, but I mean, the sales are off the chain. I'm very grateful to any listeners who have bought it because it's done extraordinarily well. It's really in the first month in the audio ebook and hardcover exceeded my publisher's lifetime expectations. And those expectations for them were kind of aggressive and ambitious, and it's done it in a month. So we feel really good about where the message is getting out and will continue. And then generally you want to put a paperback out, you know, 9 months or a year later. And they put the paperback out yesterday because the demand is so high and the, and with the hardback going out of stock, we wanted to have the paperback there on Amazon for holiday sales.
Well done, buddy. All right. Well, we were bombed this week with listeners sending in great stories. I have tried, you probably have noticed in your inbox, I think I have now emailed you three different versions of the run list. Good stories just keep coming in. This is the state that just keeps on giving. It's a cornucopia of weird and offbeat news. But the thing I wanted to start with was something that I just picked up on this morning. At 10:13 a.m., California plans to be abortion sanctuary if Roe v. Wade is overturned. This is an interesting story, and I'm only starting at the top here because it does link back to something we talked about right after Texas passed its, I think it's called Senate Bill 8 in Texas, which was a restriction on abortion rights. If you prefer, I prefer to say maybe saving some more human beings. And at that point, Newsom came out and basically offered that California would become an abortion tourism destination or a death cult tour, if you like. And he has doubled down on this, along with a group of a coalition of some, let me see, where is it here? For more than 40 abortion providers and advocacy groups released a list of 45 recommendations for the state to consider if the high court overturns Roe. Here's my favorite part. Democrat Governor Gavin Newsom started the group himself, and in an interview last week with the Associated Press said some of the report's details will be included in his budget proposal in January. That's your red flag that this is going to cost taxpayers money. So we've all got a stake. We've all literally got skin and money in this game. Newsom said, we'll be a sanctuary, adding that he's aware patients will likely travel to California from other states to seek abortions. And we're looking at ways to support that inevitability and looking at ways to expand our protections. What's fascinating about this, David, is the willingness of the state not merely to continue business as usual with regard to abortion, but to actually spend California taxpayer dollars in support of people traveling here. The report recommends funding, including public spending, to support patients seeking abortion for travel expenses, such as gas, lodging, transportation, here's my favorite, and childcare. It asks lawmakers to reimburse abortion providers for services to those who can't afford to pay, including those who travel to California from other states whose income is low enough that they would qualify for Medi-Cal payments. It's kind of mind-boggling to me. I read enough around left and right literature. My favorite abortion rights writer, if you will, is David French, who continually points out that the culture is drifting dramatically toward a more moderate or pro-life position. We've talked about this. We have flogged this issue so much that I was almost hesitant to bring it up. David, any thoughts before I move on to new madness?
Correct me if I'm wrong, because you're more of a student of the 19th century than I am, evidenced by your PhD in John Sutter. But were there not slave states that as free states were expanding, slave states would kind of want to market themselves as come here, you know, bring your slaves. We're a yes. place that.
Yes.
Am I being unfair in making this analogy here that this is sort of California in the 21st century acting like some of the slave states of the 19th century, and that they are in a really kind of uncomfortable way wanting to market their evil as an attraction for other evil?
Well, yeah, I think your analogy is exactly right. And what's interesting, of course, is that abortion providers and their allies constantly see this in precisely the opposite way. That is that they are the underground railroad for all these poor women. If you look at the photographs of demonstrations outside the Supreme Court or in Texas, it's women holding placards with a picture of a coat hanger. And I don't need to explain why that is. There might be sensitive listeners of a tender age. But the fact is that they carry this around as an emblem of their willingness to secret people across state lines to support them in their effort to end a life. And I'm a half a loaf guy. Like, I would take almost any kind of moderate position right now. I would accept more moderating legislation. This is extraordinary. This is an extraordinary expansion of California's ambition to kill the potential offspring of people from other states. I keep working on an essay called California is a Menace to Society. That's a riff on an album that you'll appreciate, especially David. You know what I'm talking about. I'm writing dirty and flashing my 9 on the 5. So we're just a bad state. Like, we are really wrecking America.
It's a bad state. And I mean, it's just really kind of evil. That's all I have to say. It's really evil. Right. Yeah, I get the analogy. I mean, if you want to say like, no, we're not looking to do something evil. We're looking to avoid something evil. And what we're trying to avoid here is a poor woman having a pregnancy. you know, I guess the problem with that is that that isn't what they're doing at all. And so it is a weird thing for me to say, but you could almost argue that the slave states are worse than that. There was a real explicit self-awareness and self-consciousness about their belief that what they were doing was because they considered the black subhuman or lesser human. And they just said so. And I'm like, oh, they're going to make you treat blacks like humans there, but come here to our state and we'll allow you to participate in chattel slavery. And the evil of our day has been reduced to the evil of the serpent in the garden, who not only does evil, but feels the need to lie about the evil he's doing, has to be a deceiver.
I think it's I love the analogy. And what I would say, though, is that I was going to say the left, but abortion rights advocates would have played with language in a way that I think is an attempt, just like the Southern slaveholders, to diminish the sanctity, the value of the life of the child. Right.
Yeah, but how come they let us, you know, I agree. I mean, I think the pro-choice language, but and they do it with the fetus, and there's a lot of scientific mumbo jumbo that is incredibly deceiving and dishonest. But I always have thought that for all that, which is all true, and I'm really sensitive to the subject, as you know, because I do find language so important, unlike your old friend Derrida.
Mm.
But the pro-life label is one that I'm surprised they've been willing to let us have.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Yes, they actually do use this now in the common vernacular.
Yeah, yeah.
I really wanted to start our conversation by noting that for our listeners, this is, I love to start with history, but this time it's not 19th century or John Sutter related. It's December 6th, 1969. December 6th was the anniversary, the 22nd anniversary of Altamont. Do you remember Altamont, the Altamont Speedway Rolling Stones concert? I know you weren't even born yet, were you, 1969?
I was not. And I can't believe you just asked that. Do I look that old?
No, brother. I just always think of you as brother. And right. Yeah, not yeah. Nephew or son.
Or grandson.
Yeah. So for those who are interested, I'll put the documentary online. I remember seeing this when I was I was probably 16 when I saw the movie, the documentary, Altamont. It was called Gimme Shelter, named after the Stones tune. And what happens at Altamont is so remarkable. Let me just cite something here that I think is really kind of interesting about this, if I may. It's that you've got Jagger saying, I'm just going to find this here. So sorry. It's the whole idea is that the Stones are going to end up with a free concert. They're touring the U.S. They're going to end with a free concert at Altamont Speedway. They can't have it at Golden Gate Park, which is where they wanted to have a free concert, because get this. San Francisco city officials and police said, not a chance. You're bringing, you know, 100,000 or 300,000 hippies and biker gangs together to party inside San Francisco. Can you imagine them stopping this today? No, of course you can't. But then they had more common sense than we have now in San Francisco. And here's Jagger describing it on the documentary. He says, the location is not Golden Gate Park, but somewhere adjacent to it and a bit larger. It's creating a microcosmic society, which sets an example to the rest of America as to how one can behave in large gatherings. And of course, what happens next is absolute chaos and violence. A black concert goer was stabbed to death, first beaten, then stabbed to death by Hell's Angels, who were remarkably, inexplicably, I think, brought in to provide security at Altamont. Altamont's a speedway, by the way, just outside of the city. And my gosh, it is just such a dark, dark end. And I'm not original in saying this, that, you know, the whole 60s ethos of hippies, peace, sex, and love kind of ends at Altamont or Kent State later, if you prefer. But the fact is, here are the Rolling Stones. You know, they're supposed to be celebrating this utopian vision of a future in which people just get along. And there's a biker gang that beats to death a black concert goer, and the concert continues. There's a great headline in, I think it was a Chronicle. I'll try to find it for us. headline is, before Astroworld, there was Altamont. And of course, Astroworld is a reference to the concert, huge concert festival in Houston, and just recently ended in a death. The concert is headlined by Travis Scott, and remarkably, Travis Scott continued even as people were being crushed to death. That is almost explicable in terms of just bad crowd control and people getting crushed, not purposely murdered. But the Stones participated in this thing, and there was just something very black. I mean, you've got albums like His Satanic Majesty's Request, Sympathy for the Devil. I don't mean to go all religious on you here, David, but there is just this weird thing about playing with satanic language. And even in the documentary, the writer of this article before Astroworld, there was Altamont, says the entire 90 minutes of the documentary bristles with an electricity and a darkness. The music sounds vital and dangerous even now. One can only imagine how threatening it sounded to suburban America 50 years ago. The narrative arc is that of a horror movie. Very few people who watched the opening half hour at Madison Square Garden, where happy stage invaders are whisked away smiling by security without knowing how the story ends. The film frames the Stones as victims and doesn't mention Meredith Hunter's name once. Meredith Hunter, the African-American guy who was beaten to death by the Hells Angels. Anyway, that dark moment. I was going to talk about the state of Jefferson election. I'll skip that. Going to talk about another article I read about Sutter, about John C. Fremont. Going to skip those. And let's move on to Kamala Corner, shall we, David? Have you been following the drip, drip, drip of Kamala Harris?
Very, very closely.
Yeah, so the story that I referenced for you, I think in my third iteration of the run list here, is... it was in the San Francisco Examiner, and it's really a remarkable piece. It's by a guy named Gil Duran, and Gil Duran was actually, he's the editor of their commentary page at the Examiner, but he was also on Kamala's staff for an entire 5 months while she was attorney general, and he quit. And he documents that, you know, like the staffers today who were simply fleeing the rat-infested Kamala Harris ship of the vice president's office, he says, even back then, she was disorganized. She was a bad manager. She blamed others. She was an awful boss, and she was ineffective. So I could go on, but I think, you know, the thing that he lays out a kind of pathology of how bad she is, and how kind of unprincipled and ungrown up, and then says, you know, sexism and racism also play a factor. He had to trot that out to sort of establish his bona fides, I guess. But the bottom line here is, for me, just that this is not something new. We in California saw this coming.
Well, I kind of don't agree that the biggest story is what he's saying about her. Like, I don't mean to be, you know, rude to some of the media outlets' coverage, but I am being kind of serious, though, not trying to be funny. I'm really bored with like reports of that she was ineffective or rude, or she was abrasive or had a bad reputation. And I mean, I say that I'm bored by it because it is kind of old news, and it's redundant to a lot of other things we've heard at different levels and dimensions and phases of her career. But I think that there's a very big story here. I just don't think it's the story you're hitting on yet. I don't care what any of these people are saying about her. I care why they're saying it. You follow my distinction there?
I do. Why? What's their motivation? I want to know
what makes someone who is a party insider, who at some level, past, very likely present, very likely future, has some of their professional well-being connected. And I would like to know to their reputation, to their relationships, to their network. What makes somebody decide to come out and say these things? Who benefits from someone leaking on it? And I go back to when Donna Brazile, who was brought in to head up the DNC, the Democrat National Committee, when that gal from Florida, I can't remember her name, she was wench of a human being, but I don't remember why she got shot to pieces, but she was gone. And they brought in Donna Brazile, who was Michael Dukakis campaign manager. She was, I think, a 30-year career as a very high-level Democratic Party insider. She was deeply involved in the campaign of 2016. And about a month or two after Trump was inaugurated, hers was one of the first books to come out, okay, doing an autopsy of what had happened in this just diabolical election that saw Donald Trump defeat the anointed Hillary Clinton. And she just hammered Hillary Clinton and hammered the way the Clinton team didn't deal with the DNC. And she was the one who, to this day, revealed more about all that the DNC did to fix the thing against Bernie Sanders. That was not reporters, and that was not Republicans who released a lot of that. It was Donna Brazile. And I remember saying to myself, there's no way in the world that she's just going rogue. There's just no way that there was donors and insiders, party, you know, VIPs and others of various agenda that said, Hillary is down for the count and you need to go break her neck and put her out to pasture forever. And has anybody since Trump beat Hillary by 80,000 votes across four states ever even intimated at the idea that Hillary would ever run again? No, it's a question.
No.
I think that that was what was going on there with Donna Brazile, was you're going to go make sure that this person can't ever breathe again, because the donors said, she just lost us the presidency to this guy.
That guy, yeah.
And we've been doing this thing of all, you know, we didn't let the VP Joe Biden run in 16 when he would have won because of this 20-year party entitlement to the Clinton family. And it was that she was put out to write it. So it's a very long setup, Will. I apologize. But the reason I bring that up is that the stuff going on with Kamala, the drip, 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 the way the WAPO covers it, the way Politico covers it, there are people that are trying to end Kamala Harris's career. They're doing a fantastic job, and they are not Republicans. They're not Republicans.
No, I think you're right. It's fascinating. Here's a piece of evidence that I wanted to cite in support of your argument. One of the things that Gil Duran does is talk up Pete Buttigieg, who says that he asserts that Kamala must be jealous of him. He writes, Harris appears jealous that Buttigieg is getting good press in the transportation job, which has given him a starring role in Biden's successful $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. Can you think right now of any evidence that transportation and infrastructure are positives for Joe Biden? My argument is almost everybody in America now knows the phrase supply chain, something that was kind of insider logistics business language.
And they don't know it because they have all been taught to finally have gratitude for how they get products.
Right. No, they're not. So if I kind of look at the possibility that you're right, not just the possibility that you're right, I look at the fact that you are right. Part of the evidence is that we're seeing people like Gil Duran float other possible candidates for 2024, like Pete Buttigieg, who's, you know, took off, what, 6 weeks in the middle of a transportation crisis to go help on parental leave with a child he did not bear.
Every time you say, what do you mean didn't bear? He was in the hospital in a bed. What are you talking about? He didn't bear the kid. Who do you think delivered the kid if it wasn't Pete Buttigieg? Now, the thing is that it could have been his partner. I don't know, or his husband, because I don't know which one of them gave birth to the baby. But I saw both of them laying in the bed on medical leave.
Yes.
So someone delivered that baby and needed a little 6 week rest.
I'm willing to acknowledge that I too was exhausted in the early childhood of four children, and I think it aged me. That's why I look 61, but I'm actually just 27. So I get it, but you are the transportation secretary with this big, bright future, and you take time out to go do this thing in the middle of an extraordinary global crisis, about which I would love to say a little bit more later. Okay, your point taken. I got it.
I just think all the people criticizing Buttigieg for that maternity leave have never delivered a baby themselves. They haven't ever suffered from some of the post-delivery challenges that a young mother can go through. And I think it's easy for you to say you should have gone back to work because you're a dad.
That's true.
I want to be clear. I can literally do this all day. Like I can spend the rest of the podcast. I don't care if we talk about anything else.
That's why I've barely touched my coffee. I can't afford a new mic.
I'm so unafraid of being canceled as someone who left a position at a Fortune 100 company to start my own business that I can literally sit here with a total authentic wonderment at the audaciousness of them taking that picture in a hospital bed in a maternity ward as if they had just delivered a baby. But I would have been totally fine with a couple of dads who, and people have different, you know, opinions on all this stuff. I'm not going there.
No.
Where I'm going is the ridiculousness of acting. Like, why do they posture that photo that way?
Yeah, that was offensive in so many. That was just pure theater. It was weirdly weird.
It was creepy. And and then the 6 week leave thing, I guess, you know, I don't know what to say on that. Because that part, I guess people could be offended. I would say there's a part of paternity leave that I don't understand at all. And then there's a 6 week part of it that I really don't understand. And then there's the Secretary of Transportation in a supply chain crisis that I really, really, really don't understand. So at three different levels, your podcast co-host is just confused as hell. Like, I don't have any idea what's going on. Sorry. Like, wouldn't you just say, like, yeah, a lot of times we support paternity leave because even though we haven't done it for 7,000 years, that was like cavemen not being appropriately supportive to the mom at home who's under-rested and undernourished and dealing with the various challenges of newborn. And so even if a lot of you think it's something to snicker at, a little paternity leave here for the dad to be home a couple weeks to help out is a good idea. And I'd be like, yeah, you know, all right. And it's like, okay, I don't necessarily see that, but I'll go along. And then you add these other pieces to it. And I'm just, I think he has set back the cause of paternity leave like years, because most now it's like a punching. It's a punchline.
It really does seem like a sitcom at this point. Hey, Devin Nunes resigned. From Congress. God. Yeah.
So a punchline.
There's going to be a special election by January. State law requires this. I won't get into the weeds. It's a lot of complexity without a lot of light down there. But the bottom line is there's likely to be a special election. And here's why that's kind of critical. I sent you in the last
critical. Year,
because the redistricting that's going on currently, the new redistricting map will create a more competitive district once it goes into place by the time of the primary in June. Mm-hmm. And it'll mean Democrats have a better shot at it. So he resigns now, therefore triggering a kind of a time limit during which we must have a special election. Mm-hmm. And it's not a state law. It's a federal law. So we have this opening. Nunes is out. He's, you know, famously taken a job as CEO.
A Republican can't lose that district.
Could under the new redistricting map. That's what's interesting. Take a look at 538.
Can you tell me on air who's telling you this?
A number of people. No, it's in a number of different places. I'm just reading. The story that I sent to you most recently in the most recent iteration is from 538. Uh-huh. And that's the Nate Silver outfit, but it's not Nate Silver writing this piece. But he does think that the writer here says the new lines are likely to change somewhat before being approved, but the draft moved Nunes's district from a partisan lean of Republican plus 11, that means 11 percentage points redder than the nation as a whole, to D plus 5, meaning that it would be 5 points bluer. So if you wait to fill the seat, it's until the redistricting map goes into place, it's likely to favor Democrats. And if that happens, then you got a challenge. So what you do is you bail out now, as Nunes did. A Republican incumbent runs and wins in the current configuration of that district and then runs as an incumbent in June and then is in the primary. So I think that's part of the calculation here. And I do go to 538 for a lot of statistical stuff. I ought to have asked my colleague Brandon Ristoff to go over these numbers for us, but I did not. In any case, it's just kind of an interesting analysis, aside from the fact that he is being handed an easy path out. I mean, easy for Nunes. He's going to go to work for a Trump media organization that says it will basically supplant all other social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, et cetera. Any other thoughts about the former, soon to be former congressman?
I do have some thoughts, but I don't think a lot of our listeners will want to hear them.
Hey, we were talking about Pete Buttigieg in a global supply chain crisis that's especially centered right here on California. This is another episode of California is a Menace to Society. Joe Biden, the Department of Labor Secretary, gosh, Marty Walsh, I believe is his name. He's the guy who was a Teamster hack out of Boston who became the mayor and then now is head of Department of Labor. They all showed up at the ports of Los Angeles to say, hey, there's nothing to see here. We've cleaned it all up. And they were especially wanted to underscore the participation and the cleanup of the ports. We had this massive cargo backlog over there, you'll remember. And they claimed, we've got it all cleaned up. No more backlog. And we want to thank the union, the International Longshoremen's Workers Union, for helping us clear this backlog. They've just been amazing. So it's a great piece by a young Buckley fellow, a kid who's, I don't know, 20 or 22 years old, Dominic Pino at National Review, who writes this piece that is just a complete takedown of that argument. He points out two things. In the headline kind of tells you one of those things. Biden hasn't fixed the port crisis. Ships are just being counted differently. So he gets way into the weeds on how we calculate how many numbers of ships are waiting at the port of Los Angeles. But all they did, David, was they took this massive collection of ships hanging out in the channel between the ports of LA and Long Beach and Catalina, and they dispersed them out farther into the channel or even into the ocean and made them wait farther away. They were only always and still are only counting ships in a very narrow little window as ships that are technically waiting. In other words, they just pushed them out of, they got rid of the line by pushing the ships farther out to sea and said, see, no more backlog. Dominic does this amazing job of showing that, in fact, there are now more ships waiting to get into the port than there were before this whole crisis, what became kind of became a bug cause celeb. Interestingly, he points out that all this glad handing and backslapping of the Longshoremen's Union is really, Dominic predicts, just a kind of prefatory, an opening move in negotiations in 2022. And ILWU union leaders have said, hey, to their workers, be prepared. We're going on strike. Now, these are people who make, David, sometimes upwards of $250,000 or $300,000 per year, and they want more. They want more, despite the fact that they have blocked virtually every kind of labor technology, which is a really important point here that Dominic also makes. The Biden infrastructure bill that Pete Buttigieg couldn't be around really to author or to shepherd through or to help, you know, to help mitigate the crisis in the supply chain. That infrastructure bill includes a provision that says new technology at ports cannot reduce the number of jobs in a port. So you can only do this to make an individual laborer more efficient, but you can't fire anybody, terminate anybody, lay off anybody. You got to have the same number of hands on every product coming through the port. So just a wonderful examination of the way in which a state and its local port authority can screw up an entire nation's supply chain under the ostensible leadership of Pete Buttigieg and then lie about it. Brilliant piece. I'll put it in the show notes.
I love the piece. Great information and proud of National Review and proud of this young intern or, you know, the Buckley
fellow. Yeah.
Fellow being able to be the one to go uncover this. This is stuff that you would think in a different life the LA Times would have been telling us.
Yes. Yes. Right? Mad props to this kid. The future is bright. Hey, I need your help on something here. This is a story about.
By the way, Will, that's nothing new. That's fine. What do you need?
I need a moment of you to be totally sober and serious so I can take a drink of coffee.
Every moment I'm sober. Every moment.
Every moment.
You think it's weird it's dark in New York City right now? It is 4:30. It is 1:30 in the afternoon for you.
Yes.
And I'm looking out my window here, looking down Park Avenue, and it is pitch dark. Wow. Partially because there's big clouds that have come in. And it's kind of cold. And last night it was a little snowy, but it hasn't been snowing today, but it's just that time of year for the time change, you know?
Yeah.
And then you were further up north and stuff. It's just dark early. It's weird.
Well, it's been doing that here, kind of. I think we're certainly dark by 5, but right now down here in Southern California, don't know. I think my friends up in the north, when I spoke to a friend of mine up in the Bay Area, it was pouring rain up there. And it's been cloudy and drizzly rainy all day down here. It's really lovely. I'm so ecstatic. So here's where I really need your help, though, because I am of two minds on this story. Have you been following the story, David, of Activision Blizzard, the gaming company? Here's the story. The CEO is a guy named Bobby Kotick, and this is a company that's based in Santa Monica. It acquired Blizzard, a gaming company that's here in Irvine.
Right.
You and I talked a few months ago about Blizzard employees walking out and demanding a kind of diversity trainings, and we're protesting sexual harassment. That's what.
And didn't
of thing.
We talk about how shocked we were? Because based on my experience with all the people who play these video games, I really expected a lot more from the people who work for the video game company. Was that part of our conversation?
I think it was, in part because these are the companies that have produced games like Call of Duty and World of Warcraft, which are, you know, notoriously violent. But they've also produced Candy Crush, Tony Hawk, Guitar Hero, those kinds of things. And I'll just acknowledge here that I am not a gamer.
I don't even like people use the word gamer. I don't even say I'm not a gamer to say that I'm not a gamer, because it makes me sound like a gamer.
Ah, yeah,
I'm not a loser. Go ahead. Cause I'm going to say things. So just go ahead.
Are they going to let us put this on the air?
They're going to make us put on there. Every video game you just listed as an example, all I could think of was a point of GDP coming off over the last 10 years
and
of economic growth as 30-year-old men devoted 12 hours of their waking life.
Yes.
Or no, they're not awake 12 hours, as they devoted 8 hours of their working life to these different games. But go ahead.
So here's the story. This big gaming company is now kind of under assault for claims of sexual harassment and even sexual assault inside the companies. They are being sued by former employees who say that there's a kind of a frat boy culture, a term that offends, I'm sure, everybody who was ever a member of the Greek system. But
No. It does not.
Oh, at SC it did.
It's like Wall Street, Oliver Stone's movie. And people would say, like, that portrayal of Gordon Gekko, is that offensive? And then most of them were like, no, you know, they liked it. I think most Greeks like the frat boy connotation. Am I wrong? I don't know.
Well, when I was at USC, people in the fraternity system.
Well, I'm sorry, but we are talking about a different era than when you were at USC.
When your grandfather was at USC, David. I had a guy pull me aside.
Greece was still the number one performing country on earth when you were at USC.
And the number one performing play on Broadway. I think I was playing in a punk band. We were playing a fraternity party, and I just said between songs something about want to thank all the frat guys for bringing us here. And somebody pulled me aside after the next song and said, "We don't call our fraternity a frat for the same reason we don't call our country a." You got it. And fraternity, frat, country, abbreviation. So let's skip over that. But it was just seemed as a defensive term. Okay. So anyway, long story short, this guy, Bobby Kotick, according to a Wall Street Journal piece that came out, about 3 or 4 weeks ago now. I've been meaning to get to this story. Sorry. But it's a fascinating story for reasons that are even more important now, I think. So there's all this internal turmoil and these accusations that the company is, you know, really evil on the inside, that even the employees are upset. And that's, and whatever one makes of that, like I'm open to the possibility that, as the Wall Street Journal says, the CEO who's run this just phenomenal company, he is apparently one of the highest paid executives at a publicly traded company in the U.S. I think he made like $150 or $60 million last year. It's pretty good income if you can get it. But anyway, the Wall Street Journal's take is he said he didn't know about this stuff. Turns out there's some evidence that perhaps he did and that he was trying to suppress it or spin it. And whatever one makes of that, there's nobody who's listening here who says, oh, boy, I'm glad people are being sexually assaulted and raped harassed. But I think everybody might say, let's wait to see the facts, even though the Wall Street Journal now claims to have laid them out. Here's the interesting spin that I wanted to take on the story, to me anyway. It's this newer story that, here's the headline. This one says, Activision Blizzard, that's the gaming company, faces new pressure from group of state treasurers. So these heads of these treasury secretaries from a number of states, all of them blue states, mind you, California, Massachusetts, Illinois, Oregon, Delaware, and increasingly blue, Nevada, called in to ask to meet with the company's board of directors regarding their, quote, response to the challenges and investment risk exposures that face Activision. Here's my question. We're always concerned here, you and I, always concerned about the extent to which the state is trying to meddle in people's lives, regulate business. And at this point, you have people who can make a legitimate claim. Hey, look, I run the CalPERS, you know, the California Pension Fund. I'm the biggest investor. What do you guys call those kinds of investors when they're institutional investors? Is that what they are? These big guys?
Right. Yeah.
So I'm one of the biggest institutional investors on the planet. So what I say is really important, and I need to be very careful about where I invest the public's money. This is people's retirements we're talking about after all. So I need to know what's going on inside the companies I invest in. And so I need to do my own due diligence. At what point does that in your mind, because I know you do this, that's part of your job. You're looking at the financials of companies you invest in and industrial spaces you invest in. At what point does the state's treasurer, the who manages these pension funds, become just another way to push, I'll just say it, woke stuff into major U.S. companies like Activision Blizzard? I just want to stipulate, let's just pretend this stuff is true about the CEO and about the corporate culture. Stipulated, don't know that that's true, but let's just stipulate it for purposes of the conversation. What do you think about state treasurers leaning on a board on an issue like this? Does it make you queasy as it did me when I first read the story?
Well, of course, there's a lot of elements where someone could go with the story. There's another element that I'm equally interested in, which is the really dangerous thing going on for companies with young employees to play in, to go woke, to facilitate a culture and worldview of wokeness, to think that they're going to be immune from it, and then to find out that the woke weapon they gave to the wokey wokesters is being used to cut down their own wokey heads. And these people have no idea what the hell is going on. They have provided, it's very similar to that old adage about if they'll cheat with you, they'll cheat on you. And so when the mistress then ends up marrying the guy and is surprised later when the guy has an affair on her, you know what I mean?
Yep.
What these wokey woke firms don't get is that these people are not your friend. Okay. And Google is running into this stuff and Facebook's running into it. And you think like, what in the world have we done wrong? We are so woke and we do all these things and we wouldn't cover the Hunter Biden story and we put up BLM things and we did all kinds of rainbow flag stuff for, you know, we're one of you. And then all of a sudden something kind of goes wrong and someone has to be at work one day and someone cheated on someone else in the office. And next thing you know, they're selling them down the river. So if you think you're going to be immune from the cancel culture world you're creating by being woke, you better understand how utterly pagan these people are that you're getting in bed with, because they're going to smack you in the face.
Well, we've seen this. Yeah, you and I have talked about this issue multiple times with other companies, with Google, with Apple. There were walkouts at Google because the company wasn't woke enough. We saw the Netflix story about 3 or 4 weeks ago with regard to Dave Chappelle's special when, 13 or 14 transgender activists gathered outside and the mass media from all over the country descended on it to show this incredible upset inside Netflix. You're absolutely right. This is handing the people the stick with which they're going to beat you. Interestingly, this guy, the CEO, Kotick, sorry here, blanking on his name again, Bobby Kotick. Let me see. Here we go. 58 years old, one of the highest paid chief executives of a U.S. publicly traded company, pay package last year valued at $154 million. But after the Journal approached Activision, this is in the Journal story, quote, in October, after the Journal approached Activision with questions for this article, Mr. Kotick told employees he would, quote, ask the board to reduce his total annual compensation to $62,500. And that the company was implementing a zero tolerance harassment policy and ending mandatory arbitration for harassment and discrimination claims. So instead of, I mean, again, maybe he's guilty. Maybe this company is vile inside. Maybe the kind of, I would argue, murderous, homicidal shooter games these guys have created actually sort of permeate the culture of the place. But it is interesting that he has entirely capitulated, cutting his salary to something that wouldn't allow him if he just had that and not the, you know, bank he's been making.
Yeah, they do that. There's a lot of ceremonial like penance, you know, that goes on. It's funny for how anti-religious so these people claim to be. They sure do a lot of very ceremonial flogging and so forth. Yeah. I'm over this stuff. You know, I just am just sick of it. But you brought up the other angle, which was the kind of terroristic component of pension managers coming in and wanting to babysit the behavior of boardrooms. So here's what I'll say to the self-righteous pension managers that are on the lookout to make sure that everybody is behaving wokey woke at the firms they're invested in. Let me do a full access, full transparency investigation into every one of your lives. I want to know everything going on with you. I'd like to know your kids. I'd like to review their social media accounts. I'd like to tear up and down of the dating history, past issues at bars, at parties, with alcohol, with sexual activity, with every person that works for CalPERS. Can I do that? And let's turn this over and let's just make sure that all of you people have sworn the right orthodoxy and the right perfect compliance with the wokey woke gospel here, because what they are a bunch of hypocrites that can't stay in their own lane. And I'm not defending the Activision thing. I've already said what I think about those situations, but then the CalPERS people using their role in this kind of puritanical sense. It's like all of, I don't even know like who's wearing what hat anymore. Yeah. I do know this. Work on your investment returns. Just work on your investment returns.
But see, that's, David, the cleverness of this move. It's the camel's nose under this tent. And that is that they say that's what they're doing. They say they protest that their concern is that if they invest in Activision, that gee whiz, your company might go down in flames over this. You're earning a lot. You know, you're going to start losing money and our investors, our investments will suffer. That's the cleverness of this, I think. And the concern for me is that these guys
and so they're concerned about a party culture that doesn't have all the wokey woke rules set up and affecting their investor returns. All right. Well, I can very easily solve for this for them. I don't want to investigate if Activision's got a party culture, and I don't want to investigate if it's going to hurt returns or not. I'm going to take them at their word that they're worried it's going to hurt returns. And then I'm going to go do an investigation on their background in the party culture.
So your new law, if we suddenly wave a wand and you're the new king of California, is let he who is without sin cast the first stone. I just remember that great moment in the Bible is they're going to stone Mary Magdalene, the Pharisees, and Jesus kneels down in the dust and starts writing something. And they kind of peer over his shoulder and realize he's writing in the dirt the list of their sins. And they one by one drop their stones and drift away. I like this rule. This is awesome.
But the reason I'm saying it is not because I'm so bothered by the fact that at like a typical Cowper's, you know, conference that might take place at the like Doubletree Hotel in Bakersfield, I'm not really concerned about the fact that they have people who get drink too much at the bar and go back to the room with one another. I'm concerned about the fact that these people are pretending they care about what happens at Activision. I think all the party culture stuff at these places is abysmal, but I have a reason to think it. They don't. What they're doing is playing to the wokey woke crowd. And what really bothers them is a completely separate set of standards and that I don't think actually bothers them at all. Mm-hmm. And so this is an opportunity for virtue signaling. That's what bothers me. So to the extent that we're not talking about the merits of the case, because my point is more when people claim they care about something and all, it's like Jonah's point about when people say the world's going to end in 3 days of climate change. If we don't stop carbon emission now, we have got to reduce carbon emission or the whole world's going to blow up. And then he goes like, okay, so we look at nuclear, and they go, we're not looking at nuclear. And he goes, okay, well, that's fine. Maybe nuclear is bad policy, but you don't care about the world blowing up
in 3 days
on carbon.
Right. Yeah.
You cannot have it both ways. These people at CalPERS don't care about what's going on at Activision. It's virtue signaling any more than most of America cared about the issues of race relations in summer of 2020. Because when people care about it, they do more than put a box up on Instagram. I'm done with this subject.
Hey, we got a whole button, get you out of here on time. Can I just point out a couple of stories about COVID that are absolutely fascinating? Again, National Review, Caroline Downey, one of my favorite reporters over there. Here's the headline. First U.S. case of Omicron variant confirmed. What state? California.
Oh, my God. We have a case?
But this was the first case. So here's a part of, and it's not just in California. It was in the Bay Area, David. So you
this person, it was an awful story to hear. No symptoms.
No symptoms.
At all.
You mean they didn't know they had this? This is terrifying.
Yeah.
No, but the reason I find that just ironic, you'll get it, is that we're in the most lockdown we're in the most lockdown region of the most lockdown state in America. And where does Omicron pop up first? In the Bay Area, of course. Santa Cruz County brings back.
Well, I guess I don't want to push back with you because you're my co-host and we're
push
brothers.
Back, baby. Push.
I don't think that's a thing. I don't think there's anything like, oh, wow, California, they try to be so tight on COVID and they got this one case through. My point of it is this case is not a thing. And neither are the other 15 states. And neither are the 330% increases in South Africa.
That's right.
That have been accompanied now over 3 weeks by a 24.1% decline in mortalities.
That's right.
So this mutated with a cold. And they go, well, it's interesting. You have an infectiousness of like a common cold, and it has the severity of a common cold. And as I wrote in my own daily investment commentary the other day, and it turns out the reason why is because it is a cold.
A common cold.
It's the first COVID mutation that is the blend of the COVID-19 virus with another coronavirus that we refer to as the common cold. This is one of the most embarrassing, and there's a long list. There's a hall of fame of this stuff. This is one of the most embarrassing moments of the COVID period that we got suckered again, or that many people got suckered again into the media's hype machine. And I truly believe from the bottom of my heart that the media and the politics, that this stuff has changed. People are over it.
There was
I interrupted you. I hijacked your story.
No, that's fine. There was a great interview with the Surgeon General on National Public Radio. And right after the Surgeon General got done saying, hey, look, this new Omicron is not quite as serious. It's not as lethal. It spreads very rapidly. He finishes just sort of downplaying the hysteria. And the NPR reporter, who almost seems not to be listening, says, well, there is this terrifying contagiousness of this thing, though. Terrifying was the word he used. Okay, Santa Cruz County brings back indoor mask mandate as coronavirus cases rise. This is exactly to your point. You can have more cases, less mortality, and fewer hospitalizations, but Santa Cruz is still bringing back the indoor mask mandate, and here's the money shot. I want to thank Chris Morton for sending this one in. Under the rules, everyone, regardless of vaccine status, must wear a mask in indoor public settings, as well as in private settings, including homes. Thank you, Santa Cruz. Let's move quickly.
You know what I'm sick of is the murder that has been committed by people that take their mask off in the shower.
Yeah. We need those. Yes, absolutely. Leave your mask on even then.
Did you know, Will, that I don't even own a mask anymore? You know how, like, during the thing when you had to have one all the time and it was like the thing and all that. And I was never like this big anti mask guy. No. I was just sort of like, yeah, you know, whatever. But I had like masks and the kids would leave the house. You had to in certain places. I think for a while, Uber wouldn't let you in without a mask and stuff like that. But I don't even have a mask. I don't have one. I don't even know where I wear a mask ever.
I had to borrow one from my mechanic this morning so that I could climb into an Uber.
Borrow one off of his face? That's the most disgusting thing I've ever heard. Like, you for sure have COVID right now. You have COVID 20.
I definitely have oily skin now. I climb into the Uber and I, you know, start to pull it out and the guy's not wearing a mask. I said, would you like me to put a mask on? And he said, no, why? Well, because the app makes me click a little thing that says I understand.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's all theater just as well. That's been there forever. Okay. So, you know, right. I use a car service all the time now and I click that box and I don't ever wear a mask. But I did get picked up. I was at dinner with a couple guys on my team at Fleming's in Newport Beach about a week and a half ago or something. And the guy came in and I clicked the thing and I sat in. He goes, do you have a mask, sir? And I go, no. And he goes, would you like me to give you one? And I go, no. I go, but to be honest, sir, if you feel uncomfortable, I'm very happy to get another car. I'm not going to wear a mask, though. But I said it so politely. And he goes, well, you know what? You're already in the car. And I go, again, I'm not trying to be a problem. If you're uncomfortable, I'm very happy to get another car, but I'm uncomfortable wearing a mask. And he goes, no, it's okay. And then as we start driving, he starts saying, you don't know what to believe and the this and that. We have about a 12-minute, you know, ride down to my house. And finally at the end, he goes, sir, of all the people that have opinions on COVID and masks, I've never talked to anyone that was as gracious and courteous and thoughtful. And I not only appreciate your perspective, I want to thank you for your civility. He didn't use that word, but basically, you know, some kind of synonym for that. And he goes, I want you to know I'm not wearing a mask again.
Oh my gosh.
And I felt like I scored two victories.
He didn't know he had like Mr. COVID in the car. I mean that in the data sense, not the contagion.
Actually, I'm going to start wearing a t-shirt. I'm Mr. COVID.
I'm Mr. COVID. I want to thank among our youngest listeners, high school student Alex K., who was the first of many, many people to send me the story with this headline. Mom says son vaccinated in exchange for pizza at LA Unified without her consent. That's the story. Kid comes home. Mom did not want him vaccinated. She is, she really emphasizes that she is pro-vaccine, that she's vaccinated, the family's vaccinated, but not the kid because he has bad reactions to vaccines. And she's just sort of shocked that this kid was vaccinated in exchange for pizza. She's now being represented by a lawyer. You can see where that one's going to go. And then I just want to kind of pimp a story that I wrote that'll be coming out. I think it's probably already posted on the California Policy website. My colleague Brandon Ristoff did some awesome research. Headline is LA Unified officials say they'll deport unvaccinated students to the district's poorest performing school. This is a school that LA Unified set up for people who need, typically like child actors, for instance, who need really flexible schedules. They're used to handling about 1,500 students, 60% of whom permanently do not show up. They rate lower on all sort of standard achievement tests than I think every other school in LA Unified, and that's saying a lot in a district that fails to meet the sort of average of statewide performance anyway. This school called City of Angels, which has had student bodies in the neighborhood of about 1,500, is now going to have to try to take on all the kids who will not be vaccinated. LA Unified has said they're going to send anybody who doesn't meet the mandatory deadline of January 10th for a vaccine. These kids are all going to be shipped over to the City of Angels school, which is 34,000 kids, 34,000 in a school that has had a struggle to help 1,500 kids, you know, get by their classes. Lots more details in the story, which I'll pop into the show notes. David, we could keep talking like this all day, but it's running late here, isn't it?
It is, and I'm glad we were able to get this in. I apologize, it's been a bit busy. Hey, are we going to try to record in California next week?
Yeah, let's do it.
Are we already booked for that?
No, we're not, but let's do it. I have children starting to fly in from all over, literally all over the world. You and I can connect offline if you'd like and figure out a good day for us. Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. That's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you just subscribe at your favorite subscription service. And of course, rate and review the show wherever you do that. That boosts our profile and helps others find us. Pardon me. You can email us with your comments and story suggestions, just like Alex Kay and Chris Morton and Dr. Lima, one of our favorite economists. Lots of people sending us great stories. Please do that. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at the Radio Free CA. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks as ever to show producer Sarah Schutte, engineers Brian Tong and Glenn Hall, my colleague Brandon Ristoff for his great work on LA Unified, and all of our friends at National Review, especially, but not only, Jack Fowler, Rich Lowry, Charles C. W. Cook. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based Mariachi metal band, for our intro music and for creating this chance to use the words metal, mariachi, and William F. Buckley in the same space. La revolución continúa en la semana próxima.